Bibles. We're all good?
I can't see, so I need to read.
All right then, good morning everyone.
Good morning.
And welcome. My name is Michael Pellet, and I'm a pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I also teach philosophy at the University of Saskatchewan. But more importantly, this week, in our Bible studies together, my overall theme to fit with Holden's summer theme of the many-colored grace of God is to look at the unforgiven. And that is looking at five parables, which indeed talk about grace. But the ironic or contradictory thing about them is that they all end with someone seemingly or actually being unforgiven. And so how does unforgiveness or non-forgiveness fit in with the topic of grace? And how do we see this working through some of the parables of Jesus? And so that's what we'll be looking at this week. And today we're going to look at the parable of the rich farmer in Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21. And there's also a similar parable to that in the Gospel of Thomas. And we'll start out with that one and think about it a little bit because it's easy. And we'll go from there to the parable in Luke, which is a bit more difficult. Dan Vaya Jr., a biblical scholar who has spent most of his time studying and writing on parables, says that when one reads a parable, one's initial response should be, "I'm not sure what Jesus is saying, but I'm sure I don't like it." And I think today, after the parable of the rich farmer, one might up that a little bit to say, "Now that I know what Jesus is saying, I know that I don't like it." And we'll try to figure out why. And so, first of all, we'll look at Luke 12, verses 13 to 21. And please follow along, and I'll read for you the way I would translate this parable or this section. Then someone out of the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who appointed me arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Beware and be on guard against all forms of greed, because life is not measured by the stuff we possess." Then he told them a parable, saying, "The lands of a certain rich man produced a bumper crop. And he deliberated within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I do not have a place where I may gather my produce?' And he said, 'This I will do. I will tear down my granaries, and I will build larger ones. And I will gather there all the grain and my goods. And I will say to myself, Self, you have many good things laid up for many a year. Siesta, eat, drink, and enjoy.' But God said to him, "Fool, this very night they will demand yourself from you. But the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" So it is with the one who treasures up for oneself and is not rich in God. And now here's the Gospel of Thomas. There was a rich man who had much money. He said, "I shall put my money to use so that I may sow, reap, plant, and fill my storehouse with produce, with the result that I shall lack nothing." Such were his intentions, but that same night he died. Let the one who has ears hear. All right. Thomas, short, maybe sweet, maybe not. What do you think Thomas means? I'll read it one more time. There was a rich man who had much money. He said, "I shall put my money to use so that I may sow, reap, plant, and fill my storehouse with produce, with the result that I shall lack nothing." Such were his intentions, but that same night he died. Let the one who has ears hear. All right. Quick survey of the group shows all of you have ears, so.
I'm thinking we should use that for our next stewardship campaign.
Yeah.
Yes. Thomas doesn't make the point that he's unforgiven, basing on your thief.
No, Thomas doesn't. What's Thomas's point?
Thomas just says it's so I'm taken care of. It's all I.
Yeah.
Thomas just says that you don't know when you're going to go.
Life is unpredictable.
Life is unpredictable.
It's interesting about, he said about the ears, but he doesn't have the conversation. Luke, there's a conversation with God.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the guy has some direction, some divine direction. But Thomas, what's it matter if you can hear if you didn't have the discussion?
Is Thomas written supposedly after Luke was?
Hard telling. Probably. I mean, again, you know, as people try to date these things and these parables, again, this is probably part of the oral tradition that these two parables in these various forms were circulating at the same time, and then later compiled, written down. But
well, it just strikes me. I mean, carefully planning, you know, storing up, gathering, you know, planning for this long life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of retirement planning.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking the same thing. You're just retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas seems
this is not the proof text for financial planners.
Thomas seems to get right to the finger wagging.
Yeah.
This is a warning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that sense, one would say Thomas, the point of the parable is more moralistic in tone, right?
Yeah.
Don't be greedy. Don't think you can ever, you know, be so good in your planning and in your security such that your future is safe. There will be no suffering. There will be no risk or anything. Just isn't going to happen, right? And so it has a moral tone to it, and kind of the moral of the story is. But that's not where Luke will want to go, right? Luke, if we want to put it differently, is going to try to make more of a theological point than simply a moral point. So it's not just simply going to be a moral story.
Is that last line in Thomas, like the last line in Luke is the theological point that you're saying is not rich toward God. What's the last line of Thomas?
In terms of the parable itself,
yeah.
or the
right.
Let the
right.
one
just
who has ears.
He just...
Okay, that one is, such were his intentions, but that same night he died. Okay, so enough of Thomas. On to Luke. And specifically in terms of the parable in Luke, we again note the introduction there about somebody wants Jesus to be the arbiter in a family dispute about inheritance and all of that stuff. So again, money, possessions, all of those things are part of it. And then that takes us into the parable. And so I want to look at the parable proper here in terms of working some of these things through. And in terms of a very simple outline to see what's going on here and to kind of show the movement that's going to happen there. We can break this parable from Luke down into three parts. There's an introduction. There's a soliloquy. That's, of course, the rich person talking to himself. And there's the response. There's where God comes in. And so we're going to look at these three parts and the interconnectedness between these parts and see what they tell us. And so, first of all, verse 16. Note the subject there. The lands of a rich man produced a bumper crop. And the word there for the producing a bumper crop, as I translate, the Greek word there is euphoreo, from which we get the word euphoric. So think about it in that way. These lands came up with a euphoric crop. Right? Think about that. Any gardeners, have you ever had a euphoric year for tomatoes? Or at least it always seems to me zucchini is always right. But the key here is the lands produced. So you see, in that sense, bam! Grace happens in this parable, right? It's not that this. And again, all farmers know that, right? Farmers can help things along. But of course, it is the seed, the soil, the rain, the sun that produces the crop. Right? It's gift. It's grace. So the whole beginning here, and this is where the grace comes in, and we can talk about, right, the problem of mismanaging is... You start out with this abundance. You start out with this bounty. It's all grace. And so then, what do you do with it? Right? You've got this euphoric crop, and so this person now deliberates within himself. What's the problem? Yeah, you're getting way ahead of us, though, right? No, but no, we're going to get there. But what's the person's immediate problem?
No storage.
It's a problem.
No storage.
It's a problem. No storage. That's already working our way into it a little in terms of perhaps a solution. But what's the immediate problem?
Too much stuff.
Too much stuff. What am I going to do with this? Right? What am I going to do with 36 zillion zucchini? I can't even give it all away, right? I mean, that kind of thing. Too much stuff. Right? The irony there already, right? You know, if we think about it, what's our problem right out of creation itself? Too much grace. Have you ever thought about it that way? What are we going to do about too much grace? That's, and indeed, should that even be a problem? So, you know, what's the matter if you're thinking grace is our problem? Right? Boy, we got to start thinking a little differently there, don't we? So, there's the problem. Too much. And, at least again, if we anticipate Jesus' audience, there would be an answer to that problem in Jewish wisdom literature, right? That kind of practical advice on how to live life. And I'm going to look at an intertestamental piece. Sirach, chapter 31, verses 5 to 11. And you can find similar things interspersed in the book of Proverbs and all of those. If you have some Bibles that have the intertestamental literature in it, you can look it up. But I'll read this just so you would see in terms of Jesus' hearers would have thought about something like Sirach, in order to say, here's how you would handle this. One who loves gold will not be justified. One who pursues money will be led astray by it. Many have come to ruin because of gold, and their destruction has met them face to face. It is a stumbling block to those who are avid for it, and every fool will be taken captive by it. Blessed is the rich person who is found blameless and who does not go after gold. Who is he that we may praise him? For he has done wonders among his people. Who has been tested by it and been found perfect? Let it be for him a ground for boasting, who has had the power to transgress and did not transgress, and to do evil and did not do it. His prosperity will be established, and the assembly will proclaim his acts of charity. In other words, what do you do with an abundance? Give it away.
That makes me think of Bill Gates, your description right there.
Yeah. But the whole, the whole Jewish wisdom tradition would say that grace, bounty, is that gift such that you give it away for those who are not experiencing that bounty. That's what the wise one will do. And so indeed, for that person, there would be no problem. Again, this understanding of how to handle this sense of bounty. The other example that could come to mind for this is part of the Joseph story. Remember, Joseph sold into slavery in Egypt, ends up at Potiphar's house, gets into a little trouble with Potiphar's wife, in prison, interprets dreams, has the reputation of being a wise person. Pharaoh has this dream he can't interpret. Joseph does it from him. Pharaoh makes him second in command in the land. Why? What was the dream? What was Joseph's interpretation? Anybody?
Two fat cows, seven skinny cows.
Right. Seven fat cows, seven skinny cows. Meaning what?
7 years of bounty, 7 years of famine.
7 years of bounty, 7 years of famine. So what do you do?
Store it up.
Store it up. for yourself to say, boy, Pharaoh, you know, you're going to be really powerful if you get a monopoly on grain, right? We could put Cargill out of business if we do this, right? But no, right? Again, it was for the sake of, in those lean years, when there is need, this bounty will see you through. So again, the contrast here, right? Joseph is the symbol of the wise person, the wise and faithful follower of God, who knows how to act accordingly, prudently, faithfully, when grace is given. And we can say in this parable about this rich man, he ain't no Joseph. Right? That's the kind of conclusion that we can get to. And again, the first sign that something is going to be a little different here is the person has a problem, too much bounty, and what's his solution?
Store it,
but let's get more precise.
He tears down what he already has and builds a bigger house.
All right. Now, does that make sense to anybody?
Share. I said he has to share his bounty.
He should share, but his whole project is, I'm going to tear down my storehouses and build larger storehouses. Now, why would you? I mean, most of us may think, well, what I'll do is just build more storehouses, but why are you going to tear down the old ones?
Isn't that trickle-down economy? You're putting the people to work building new stuff?
All right, Ronald Reagan. Why would you tear down the old barns?
It might be ego. He wants the biggest barns in the neighborhood.
Ego? Anyone else? Any ideas?
Wasteful.
Maybe the only place that he's got to build because the rest of it is the land?
Could be. I mean, you can only, right? This is the only spot, and so these have to go so that, right, bigger and better can come up on it. I mean, I think, again, it's one of those questions that one sense is, I think this is kind of the humor that's in the parable, to show you just in one sense how foolish this person is. Because it's not really practical, prudent behavior, is it? But, okay, he's going to do it anyway, and he's going to go ahead with all of this stuff. And so there we go. We're into the soliloquy. And so we're into the second half of verse 17. And right, it's the notion he debated within himself, saying, what shall I do, since I do not have a place where I may gather my produce? Note how everything shifts to first person. Right? I, my. So much for the lands being euphoric and all of that's gone. And the other thing in this, which I just think is so neat in this parable, is that this person is so self-centered. It's not only I and my stuff that he's got to be the, you know, the whole focus, the subject matter of this story. He is so egocentric that he bumps the narrator out of the story. Remember? I mean, we started with an omniscient narrator. Somebody else, right, if you will, Jesus was telling this story, but this guy is saying, you know, get out of here, Jesus, I'm talking, right? And it's, I'm talking to myself. Self, how's it going today? Self, Not bad, self. You having a good day, self? Yes, I am, self. You know? Enough about me. Let's talk about me. It's great. This guy just bumps everything. Absolutely everything. He can't even let someone else narrate his life. He's gotta take it over. And not only then, right, is the implication of that, that he has to narrate his life, he's claiming to be the author of his life. And none of us are the authors of our lives. We may think about that, but when you think hard, it's not true. Indeed, the most we could ever be is kind of the narrators of our life. We can tell the story of what happens to us. Because most of my life, and you know, we put it that way, is what happens to me. When I go back to Saskatoon, and they'll ask me, how was Holden? I will narrate all the terrible things that happened to me up here in Holden. Right? Things happen to us more than anything else, right? We're not in control, right? We like to think we're in control. We like to think that we're the agent. And indeed, we have some sentences where I can be the subject of the sentence. Like, right, I had a cup of coffee. But by and large, most things happen to us, right, as we are in relationship. And this person totally forgets that, right? He is an isolated monad. Yes.
What's the possibility that that just fits with the whole bumper crop? He cannot even contain his ego anymore. It's just exploded. There's no way to contain it, and so it becomes sort of its own
euphoria.
Demise, euphoria. I mean, all these kinds of things. It's mm-hmm. kind of interesting to me that there may be a shift in there that it can't even be contained in that way.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, again, as we put those two parts together and to say, now, how am I going to interrelate that? Again, there's that sense, or one might say always, that danger and risk is that the more one has, the more one intensifies and isolates that upon oneself. And in that sense, right, just like you've got a bumper crop, you've got a bumper ego.
And Gavin's comment reminds me that another man, who's a Jewish man, Kushner, Harold Kushner, has a book called this is the title of the book, When Everything You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough. Mm-hmm. And he speaks a bit, it's not necessarily theological oriented, but it's human oriented in such a way that a lot of this kind of thing is provocative to us in our own ways,
mm-hmm.
even if we're not farmers, and even if we're not, we have an unconscionable thirst for what we can't control, really, but we think we can.
Mm-hmm. Or just that sense of wanting to, you know, it's never enough.
It's never gonna be enough.
We've got to have stuff.
Right.
Some of you might remember with me, George Carlin, the comedian, had a great little shtick on stuff, right? And what all counts as stuff, you know? Like, I've got stuff in my pocket, and it's lint, right? But I've got stuff in my closet, and on it goes. Was there a comment? Yes, please.
I think somebody mentioned Bill Gates earlier, the foundation that he and Melinda created, but I think there's another really good contemporary example, that's Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
Because Warren Buffett he and his wife still live in the same house that they've lived in a long time. And the wealth that he has amassed in his lifetime, he could have built a Biltmore estate that the Vanderbilts built in North Carolina, yet he didn't. He stayed in the same house. He didn't tear his house down and build a bigger one. He stayed in it. The second thing he did is he took about $40 billion something dollars of his money that he's made, and he didn't start his own foundation. He gave it to Bill and Melinda Gates, and he said, you can manage this better than I can. So he didn't put it, it didn't become the Gates Buffett Foundation, it stayed the Gates Foundation. So in other words, there, you know, there was a little humility there, I think. And so I guess the ultimate would have been to give that gift anonymously. But he sets a good example that way. I think he sets a great example, and it's kind of the antithesis of this parable.
Yes.
I want to throw this out there just to create a little controversy. I think you're being too hard on the guy. And I got 2 points. Number one, we're all just like him.
Well, give me a chance. I want to be hard on you, Peter.
And number two, how do you do self-discernment without being in the first person?
Okay.
But how? What's his self-discernment? I think you still could be hard on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of this, as this character is constructed, one of the issues is he has no capacity for self-discernment, right? That's part of the problem. I think, secondly, how do you do self-discernment? That happens in community. That's the other problem again, right? This guy boots out the narrator, even wants to be the author of his life. Well, once you become that isolated and that egocentric, there is no community. And again, that sense of self-discernment as life happens to us, part of that happening is the relationships and the feedback that we get from one another to discern who we are. I think that would be my quick answer to that question. But let's move on here a little bit, right? We've got the narrator disappears, even the author disappears. This person wants to control fully his own narrative, right? And so, in other words, he usurps the harvest. He replaces care for others simply with his own well-being. He excludes everyone from his story, from his life. And then comes up with his own answer to what is the good life. And of course, that's an answer that we all know there. NRSV says again, relax, eat, drink, be merry. Again, philosophically, Epicureanism, right? Epicurus, the one about, you know, pleasure, that indeed is the, what is the goal of life? To get pleasure and to avoid pain. And again, pleasure here need not necessarily be anything bad. Again, we're shifting this story because, if you will, to look at this person, he's a fine, upstanding, moral person, right? He's done nothing evil. It's not that his bounty has been by good or by ill-gotten gain, or we don't hear anything about mistreating workers or anything like that. I mean, truly graced, and this is his response to it, and he's going to use it for pleasure. Now this way of looking at things again has been with us, if you will, forever. I mean, it goes back to, if you look at the Gilgamesh epic, which is the Babylonian story of the flood. We have Noah and the flood. They have Gilgamesh. And there, way back in Gilgamesh already, one reads this after the flood and Gilgamesh has gotten through it. And here's what the gods have to say to about themselves and about Gilgamesh. Quote, they, meaning the gods, allotted death to mankind. Life they retained in their keeping. Thou, O Gilgamesh, let thy belly be full. Day and night be thou merry. Make every day a day of rejoicing. Day and night do thou dance and play.
Right.
So this whole philosophy of life, if you will, has always been with us. So in that sense, again, the person in this parable is doing nothing new. However, both Judaism and Christianity, in terms of their wisdom literature, are anti-Epicurean, if you will. And just two examples of that to show the contrast. The first one is from Isaiah chapter 22, verses 12 to 14. And if someone would just read that for us. Isaiah 22, 12 to 14.
In that day, the Lord of hosts calls to weeping and mourning, to baldness and putting on sackcloth. But instead, there was joy and festivity, killing oxen and slaughtering sheep, eating meat and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. The Lord of hosts has revealed himself in my ears. Surely this iniquity will not be forgiven you until you die, says the Lord God of hosts.
Jerusalem and Judah are possibly under siege from Assyria, and destruction could be imminent. What they should do, the prophet says, is engage in repentance. Their response is instead, well, we might as well eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow the Assyrians are going to kill us. So, you know, we're going to go out. We're going to go out with a party. So, but you see again, not the response the prophet calls for. The other one is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 30 to 34. And if someone would read that, please.
And why are we putting ourselves in danger every hour?
Mm-hmm.
I die every day. That is as certain, brothers and sisters, as my boasting of you, a boast that I make in Christ Jesus our Lord. If with merely human hopes I fought with wild animals at Ephesus, what would I have gained by it? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Come to a sober and right mind and sin no more, for some people have no knowledge of God. I say this to your shame.
Okay, so what Paul is saying there is it's the whole chapter 15 is about the resurrection, and if Christ be not raised, your faith is in vain. And so Paul, as it starts out there, is saying, you know, why would I undergo the kinds of sufferings that I have, the perils that faced me at Ephesus and all of these other things, if Christ were not raised? I mean, I'd be a fool. And indeed, if Christ were not raised, then I might as well be Epicurean. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you die. And then Paul goes on again to advocate his understanding of resurrection. The interesting thing here in both Isaiah and in 1 Corinthians that the prophet and that Paul point out is to illustrate that, right, it is death that prompts an Epicurean response. Right. One might think, oh, it's because of all the bounty, of all the grace, all the stuff. Now I can eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you might die. But their analysis of that is to say, why would people think that way? Because if you will, that is the despairing and despondent response to death.
Wasn't that what happened during the Black Plague? A lot I heard that people were taking this attitude up, basically.
I don't know about it. Could be. I'll take your word for that.
Yeah, I heard of those a lot. There were a lot of that type of philosophy.
Yeah.
Another point on our man from Luke here, maybe a minor point, but I see, would it have made any difference? In here, he has the abundant crop, but he never thanks God for it. I don't know if that has bearing on this or not. Or
yeah, well,
not.
That's there's no sense of thank. I mean, again, he usurps all of that in terms of just making it my stuff. But that notion, I mean, has it been your experience in terms of environmental and ecological issues that some folks, and I know this is often the response that students, I teach a course in environmental philosophy, and you know, you talk about global warming, greenhouse gases, all that kind of stuff, and most of them, students, after looking at the material and everything, think we're doomed, right? We've passed the tipping point. We can't go, but we're not going to salvage it. You know, given 50, 100 years, Seattle, Vancouver, they're all going to be underwater. Forget it. And all, you know, who knows what's going to happen. So why, you know, why reuse and recycle and all of that little nonsensical stuff that's absolutely worthless, you know? Why not eat, drink, and be merry? Because tomorrow, we're all underwater. We die. And so this whole thing about, you know, getting the pleasure, that's this whole sense of immediate gratification, and certainly we live in a society of immediate gratification and immediate satisfaction, is actually the behavior and action that stems out of despondency and despair with regard to one's own demise and one's death. I don't know, what do you think about it?
I would say amen.
Amen. Others, do you see, I mean, how do you assess? Yes?
Just one general comment to that. We're experiencing something which has never been known in the history of the world for most people. That's a thing called retirement. This has started the Industrial Revolution. People even thought about it. It used to be that most people worked from the time they were born almost until they died. They didn't have retirement. Now we have all this riches of time, which may be 10, 20, 30 years. And I'm in that category. The question is, how do you spend this time? You spend it on something worthwhile, or do you spend it on if you can be married?
Mm-hmm.
It's a new phenomenon in the world.
Well, I think it's disappearing. That's a single generation. I don't picture my generation having the opportunity for retirement. It's interesting. I mean, certainly it's a Northern European U.S. phenomenon anyway.
Yeah.
Regardless, you give it to your children.
This is my daughter.
And you said it publicly so that we are now all witnesses. Watch yourself.
Community discernment.
We will all die.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
We will all die. That's real. When, how long, what do we have? So, in terms of the response to that is today we are alive. And what do we do today?
And how can we invest? How can we look at grace today? Mm-hmm. How can we try to be tools of grace in other people's lives today? Never mind anything but mm-hmm. just grace.
Yeah, Anne?
It's very interesting what you're saying, and it sort of resonates. I go to the jail, county jail in our community every 2 weeks to do poetry classes. And I think of the when both the men and the women, we have separate groups, talk about their partying behavior. And most of these people are very, I mean, they have very desperate lives in a lot of ways. And the partying behavior is very desperate and sad and sort of with that sense of, so what? You know, there's kind of hopelessness about it.
Despair.
You know, a despair, yeah. And it's very interesting when you're saying that, because there doesn't feel like there's any joyful, even to them. The people who have plans for the future are the only ones who seem to kind of not look back on that. And I think you get something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's counterintuitive, right? Because you're going to think, you know, partying, eat, drink, and be merry. This has got to, right? This has got to be joy. This has got to be pleasure. And in fact, no, it actually is
despair
and despondency. And again, right, to think about that and work that liturgically. Think about that in terms of the way Christians party. Because, of course, we party every Sunday. And right, when we've got the sessions, looking at the liturgical seasons and how do we celebrate? Well, we had that, yes, how do we celebrate Advent? How do we celebrate Christmas? All right, I mean, that's what we do too. We just came out of it. Easter was what? A 50-day party, right? But that's not a party of despondency and despair. Right? And so, there's... Think about that too, about how we party. Yes, please.
There's a speaker at our recent Synod Assembly talked about America as the wealthiest, saddest, loneliest mm-hmm. country in the world. Mm-hmm. Which gets at some of that counterintuitive bit mm-hmm. that the wealth creates divisions and destroys community.
Okay, we're going to move on a little bit here in terms of move our way over to the response. I have a little chart here to try to note the contrast again. Literarily, what we see here structurally in this story is what's called a chiasm, chi, the Greek word X, right? And so you can see in this story here the self, and oh, maybe just a quick response to that. Why did I say self instead of soul? Because, I mean, the Greek word there is psyche, and, you know, often we translate that soul, but again, psyche is that understanding of the whole self. It's not here wanting to make a distinction between body and soul or anything like that. We're talking about the whole person here, our whole being. And so it's this man is talking to his self, his whole self, his ego, if you will. And so the self said, "You have many things laid up many years." And then God responds. This night, right, which will contrast to the many years, right, they will demand, which is a notion of take away as opposed to laid up, yourself. And again, note here the contrast. Have many things to self, because there isn't it often the case that we really think about who we are in terms of the many things, right? Who am I? I have a 27-bedroom house, 14-car garage, 6 boats, you know, on and on and on, right? Whatever. But is having many things truly self? And so again, the irony of this parable is such that while this self excludes everything else, that this is, if all you do is understand self as many things, you really are no self at all. And you all know that, but just again, how the very structure of this story comes in. The other interesting thing is, for all you biblical trivia fans, this is the only parable in the New Testament where God is a direct character. Nowhere, in no other parable, is God actually a character.
Except in this sentence, what God says, the actor is a they.
Yes, we're going to talk about that. That's because that's really fun.
How? Where is that? I mean, what's the actual word that's translated they?
They.
Which is not how it's translated in the NRSV.
No.
So it's fascinating. We're talking about the Godhead.
No, I'm not talking about the Godhead at all. We'll get there. We'll get there. I want to talk about God first. Why is it that God must respond in this parable? In terms of the logic of the narrative itself and what we've been talking about, if you will, there is only the possibility, if there is going to be a response to this man, it must be God. Why must God come into this parable? Yes?
Well, earlier Jesus had sort of said, I'm not going to intervene in this.
Okay, we can go back to that.
This isn't my game.
True?
Because man can't do it.
Why not?
Man can't respond.
Why not?
Because man is not God.
Or
thinks he or she might be. But God is different.
True.
God controls his destiny, not him.
Yeah.
Well, he shut out everybody else.
Yes.
And there is nobody else.
Right. I mean, the kind of thing is that indeed we can set up our lives, if you will. We can exclude everyone and everything else. But the whole point here is, I mean, you may want to say God controls our destiny, but here it's simply the point of, you can't shut out God. No matter what, I can work it. I've got all that stuff, so I can try and get all that in. I can even exclude the narrator. I can even engage in the fantasy that thinks I'm the author and have self talk to self. But you can't shut out God.
Only God can eavesdrop on us a little.
That's right. That's a good literary way of putting it. And so therefore, in that sense, given the logic of the story, God is the only one who could possibly respond. And so God does. And pretty tough response, right? Fool. And again, biblically, a fool is a theological category. The key text for that, Psalm 14, verse 1. The fool says in his heart, there is no God.
Right.
So in other words, fool here is not talking about your IQ or anything like that. Fool is the one that says, there is no God. Fool is the one, again, who denies that sense of God's gracious activity in the world. And so That comes, and after that, and this is again the truly the structure of the parable in the Greek here, and that's why I wanted to put it that way. It says, right, this very night they will demand yourself from you. So here's that great question. Who is our the they? Let me tell you why it's not God. And that's again part of Jewish theology and understanding, and indeed it's part of ours too. God is the God of life. God does not kill directly. Think about that in terms of the opening of the book of Job, right? God and Satan are having this conversation in heaven talking about Job to say again, oh yeah, well of course Job, Satan says to God, well of course Job loves you, God, you give him all that stuff. But if Job wouldn't have all that stuff, I mean, I'm sure he'd turn right around and curse you and that would be the end of it. So God says, well, that's interesting. Let's put him to the test. Let's see what happens. And again, at that point, God says to Satan, you know, you can do whatever you want, but I won't allow you to take his life. So that in terms of death, right, God will allow death. But God is the God of life, so the understanding here is not that God would directly, if you will, kill. So that again, here, God will allow this man's life to be taken, right? They will demand. So now, who's the they?
Angel of death.
Could be the angel of death.
The stuff.
Your barns, your eating, your drinking, your enjoying end up killing you. Right? Again, that kind of counterintuitive things, because after all, it takes, right, we have to put our life into that stuff to make it truly pleasurable and worthwhile and enjoyable or whatever. It exacts, all of our stuff finally exacts life from us. It does not give us life. That's the fantasy, that's the deception under which we live, right? Eat, drink, be merry, I've got all that stuff, that's going to give me life. No, finally all that stuff will end up killing you. That's what's going to, all that stuff is going to take your life, not give it to you. And indeed, in that sense, right, given that that's what you wanted, God will allow them to demand your life from you. That's what's going to happen. That's the end, if you will. That's the end of the story. They come in. They take charge.
Michael, do you find support for that in the language? Because that's such a tricky sentence, you know, the way it's written. In
yeah. Yes.
Or just in your logic, which,
no,
you know, I agree with, but... What about the language supports
that? The Greek verb itself is third person plural, they. It's not God with the you know singular ending there. It is truly they.
And of course the translation RSV leaves out they.
Yeah, right.
It says this very night your life is being demanded of you.
Right. But you would say, but they're not really leaving it out because they're, right, it's not saying this very night God is taking your life from you, right? They're They're accurate enough or sneaky enough that they're not pinning it on God, so that you can say, yeah, your life will be demanded from, but then when you ask, yeah, but what's the subject of that verb? I mean, I put it in there specifically. The subject of that verb is they, but we have no specific antecedent to what, okay, to whom does this pronoun they refer? So it's asking us to be smart enough to think about that. So, I know, the bell, the time is demanding my life of me. Just a few things here, right, to get you to think about. We can talk about this after class. Some nasty questions that come out of this, and that is, first of all, at least if you would read the rest of Luke chapter 12, which is also kind of an interpretation of this parable, the question that might arise is the term rich Christian an oxymoron? Is rich Christian an oxymoron? Secondly, to get even nastier, is capitalism really pragmatic atheism? Is capitalism pragmatic atheism? Because capitalism really doesn't start out with its first premise as acknowledging gracious bounty. So we'll just tease you with that one. Is capitalism pragmatic atheism? And I would like to leave you with a quote from John Calvin and his Institutes. And again, Calvin is a Reformation contemporary with Luther. He writes the Institutes. He reads Luther's Small Catechism, loves it, but says, well, you know, Luther left out a few things, so I just want to add a little bit. And when he finished his editions, it turned out to be 4 volumes, over 1,800 pages. So fortunately, he never thought that folks had to memorize it. But here's what he says. Here's what he says on, and if there are any church treasurers here, please note this. This is Calvin's advice on how one sets a church budget. Quote unquote, you give 1/4 to the poor, 1/4 for the training and maintenance of the ministry, 1/4 for the work of the church, and 1/4 to the poor. Treasurers, I'll say that again for all the treasurers. You give 1/4 to the poor, 1/4 for the training and maintenance of the ministry, 1/4 for the work of the church, and 1/4 to the poor. So, go in grace.